You are listening to Social Europe Podcast. We discuss cutting-edge thinking on politics, economy, and employment and labour with some of the most thought-provoking people around, including Nobel Prize winners and other internationally acclaimed experts. So welcome and enjoy the conversation.
Hello and welcome everybody to episode 25 of Social Europe Podcast. My name is Henning Meyer, Editor-in-Chief of Social Europe. My conversation partner today is Peter Hall of Harvard University, and we're talking about the underlying root causes of populism and what can be done to counter populism in Western democracies. I hope you enjoy the conversation. So Peter, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to me today about populism and what underlies its surge, and potentially also what can be done about the surge of populism. Let us get right into it. And many analyses of the rise of populism point to either economic or cultural reasons for the surge. But you've come up with a new framework based on subjective social status that seeks to integrate both dimensions into one approach. Could you explain to me how this actually works, and how do you combine, you know, material economic circumstances, relative social status, and feelings of respect and disrespect into one integrated framework?
Yes, I think that in some ways the contemporary debate, which is really a debate between those who think populism is mainly a result of economic distress, a revolt against globalization on that dimension, if you like, and those on the other side who think that populism is really a cultural revolt, a counter-reaction to the rise of post-materialist or cosmopolitan values over the last 30 years, that to ask, is it economic or is it cultural at heart, is fundamentally a mistake. And the real question should be, how do economic and cultural factors interact to generate rising support for populism? And there are several ways in which we can understand that interaction. On the one hand, I think we can see that some kinds of economic developments inspire shifts in cultural frameworks, which in turn yield resentment. So, for example, in past decades, it was often possible for a person to secure their own self-worth and their sense of social standing in society by telling themselves and showing others that they were hard workers, that they were responsible people. In the last 25 years, with the technological revolution, we've seen the economy change. Demand has shifted towards high-skilled labor, and the wage premium for high-skilled labor has gone up. And of course, in response to that, tertiary enrollments in college education and advanced vocational training have gone up. Well, this is a difficult economic challenge for people who don't have a college education or advanced vocational qualifications. But there's also a corresponding shift in cultural frameworks. In countries where tertiary enrollments have increased significantly, in some research I've been doing with Noam Gidron, who's a postdoctoral fellow at Princeton, we find that where college enrollments have increased the most, people who lack a college education are feeling more and more socially marginalized. So there's a way in which the cultural frames that we all live our lives through have shifted to attach, understandably, more value to more skills and more education. It's no longer enough to be a hard worker or a responsible person. You have to be entrepreneurial and skilled and polyvalent, if you like. Well, that's all well and good for those of us who are educated and maybe even polyvalent, but it's a real problem for people who don't have that kind of capacity or education. So this is that's a very good example of a way in which economic developments tied to technological change, in this case, have also shifted the dominant cultural frameworks in society in ways that make some people feel more and more remote from what is valued, from what is mainstream in society. There's another way in which shifting cultural frameworks, whose origins may lie beyond economics, also interact, if you like, with people's position in the economy. So, for instance, the last decades have seen, I think, a very prominent shift in the value that's attached to gender equality, to racial equality, for instance. And that's something I strongly approve of, and I think many, many people do. So for me, this makes the world a better place. But that's partly because I have significant social standing in the usual ways, via income, occupation, and education. But for people who don't have that kind of social esteem, social status that comes from higher incomes or better occupations or higher education, they have to worry a little bit about their social standing. They always have, and understandably, and many of them experience what is sometimes called a fear of falling, the fear of falling down to the bottom of the social hierarchy. None of us want to be at the bottom of the class. None of us want to be seen as the worst student in the class, but we also don't want to be the worst person in our social class, if you like. People whose social standing is already modest tend to erect what sociologists call social boundaries between themselves and others whom they can define as having at least lower social standing. And for many people, that means people of other racial or religious groups. For some men, it means women. I may not have the world's greatest job, but at least I'm not a woman. So we might not approve of that particular view, but this means that as values that attach importance to gender equality and racial equality become central to discourse and central to the practices that we find in politics and in the workplace, these people feel threatened. That's a second way in which, in this case, cultural frameworks that are shifting to attach more value to various kinds of equality have different kinds of effects. One kind of effect on you and me, perhaps, but another kind of effect on other groups of people. So I think that we need more research and a better understanding of how cultural developments and economic developments work together. And one way to think about that is to understand, as you've suggested, populism as a problem of social integration. And what I mean by that is that there's a way in which the contemporary social contract, which underlies all democracies, is fraying at the edges, if not broken. What is the social contract? Well, it's the sense that ordinary people have that defines allegiance to their nation and allegiance to their political regime on the grounds that, broadly speaking, that nation is providing them with what they deserve. It's ultimately about a kind of social justice. Do I have the kind of secure place in life, the kind of secure, recognized place in society? Is the society according me sufficient respect? And I think that what we're seeing today is that because of these economic and cultural developments, increasing numbers of people are feeling that they're not being accorded that social respect. That's partly because they're having more difficulty feeding their families. They're having more difficulty securing the opportunities that they hoped for their children. But it's also because the cultural frameworks have shifted, and the views of the mainstream elite now look very different than the views of ordinary people. So these people feel socially marginalized. And Noam Gidron and I have been able to measure this to some degree by looking at subjective social status, where people place themselves on a social ladder. And we find, for instance, that in 12 of the developed democracies, the subjective social status of men with without a college education, which is the majority of the population, at least the male population, no longer report the same sense of self or social status respect that they felt or that they that their analogs reported 25 or 30 years ago. So there's a way in which so by seeing populism as a problem of social integration, we can understand it as an issue that occurs because some people feel left behind. And I think that's also what the ethnographic studies in France and Germany and the U.S. Show. Many people are drawn towards right populism in particular, but sometimes left populism, because they feel that they're no longer being recognized by their societies. They're no longer getting what they deserve as citizens of those societies.
I mean, I find this very interesting because what you seem to be saying is that we should look at the dynamics of the social pecking order, whereas so far we've looked at the upwardly social mobility, basically saying, okay, women have more life opportunities being integrated into labor market and so on and so forth. And we just assumed that because other people are not in absolute terms worse off, the ceteris paribus, the rest will stay the same. But in relative terms, they've become worse off. And you seem to suggest that this relative downward social mobility, not in absolute terms, but in relative terms, that seems to underpin a lot of this sentiment.
Yes, I think that the one of the striking features of support for right populism in particular is that the people who feel that way don't always report economic distress, but they report deep concerns about the future of their society. They tend to say that society is no longer working as well as it did 30 years ago. And in particular, they tend to feel that their children do not have the opportunities that they deserve. And political scientists call these sociotropic attitudes. They're attitudes about the direction of society as a whole. And I think that's at the heart of the dilemma here. We have to realize that, yes, economic distress, stagnating incomes, to some extent income inequality, these are factors that lie behind some of the resentments that feed populism. But at the same time, at the heart of the issue, at the heart of the matter, is people's sense that society is moving in the wrong direction and no longer has a place for them.
And it could also be just generally related to anxiety. I mean, one interesting finding that I find striking that you find currently in Germany is the, well, what on first sight looks like a paradox. That's where people say that they currently feel economically secure. They feel content, but they, at the same time, they worry about the future. Exactly because they think, you know, things like the technical revolution, the jobs in the future might not be secure. They're worried about the security situation in Europe. They worry about issues such as refugees and so on and so forth. So even in countries where comparatively little support to populism has been identifiable so far, you know, you see this sort of being worried about the future. Do you think that that could be one of the sort of early signs?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's really very central here. There's no question that people are feeling apprehensive. And I think that technological change, a shifting economy, none of us really know exactly where the European or American economies are going these days. Even the best economists debate that issue with a good deal of uncertainty. So we're living through the kind of revolution that Joseph Schumpeter would have described as creative destruction. And it's quite legitimate for people to worry about whether their jobs are going to be destructed in the context of that revolution. But at the same time, it must be said that I think populist parties on the right in particular are inflaming social sentiments. That is to say, they're exaggerating the fears that are associated with immigration, or the fears that are associated with globalization, or the fears that are associated with terrorism. One of the most interesting findings in this literature, and it's a very solid finding, is that in places where there are large numbers of immigrants, there tends to be less rather than more support for right populist parties. Where support for right populist parties has been rising is often in the countryside where there are fewer immigrants, and it's particularly in towns or regions where there's been a very recent influx of immigrants. So there's a sense in which this is not as much, just as you say, not as much a reflection of current distress as fear for what the future holds.
You saw that very vividly in the Swiss referendum on immigration.
Yes,
it was exactly. Literally in the cities where most immigrants actually live, there was support for immigration. It was the countryside where a revolt basically did take place. But interestingly, I mean, none of this is particularly new. We've always had immigration. We've always had technological advancement. What do you think is the trigger? Why is this surge happening now? What is sort of underpinning this? Is it, for instance, one of the explanations I've heard a few times that mainstream politics has moved away from socioeconomic issues towards identity mm-hmm. politics? Mm-hmm. So that would basically straddle both of your dimensions in mm-hmm. your approach. That we know very well that inequality has been rising and so on and so forth. So the focus of politics has moved away from sort of these grounded economic grievances towards these issues of identity politics that might at the same time have done two things. Neglected the real material problems that people suffered, so these amassed, and at the same time exacerbated some of these cultural alienations. Mm-hmm. Do you think that sort of that move, or what do you think, why is it happening now?
No, I think that's exactly right. I think if the why now question is a good question, because there have been anti-immigrant sentiments around for decades and decades. There's been some kind of reservoir of potential support for right populism in particular. And I think that to understand why now, we have to look at both the demand side and the supply side of politics, if you like. On the demand side, you know, it must be said that in many countries, income inequality has risen relatively rapidly, and in some countries, median incomes have stagnated. So there are a set of pressures that have been building over the last 20 years. But I think even more important is the supply side of politics that you're talking about, namely the kind of strategies that parties adopt to compete with one another, to compete for votes. And there, I agree with you and those who suggest that the convergence in the economic platforms of the mainstream center-left and center-right over the last 30 years on what are, broadly speaking, neoliberal policies have greatly increased the sense among many people that no one is really speaking for them, that whoever they vote for at the next election, they're going to end up with the same set of policies. And so I think that is a basis for support for something new, something different, the kind of things that populists sometimes offer. But at the same time, as mainstream parties have converged in their economic platforms, in order to compete with one another, in order to distinguish themselves from one another, they themselves have put more emphasis in their manifestos on identity issues. And that's perfectly understandable, but it plays exactly into the hands of right populist parties, because right populist parties themselves compete heavily on identity issues, on anti-immigrant appeals, on various kind of racialist appeals and the like. So there are two ways in which this convergence of the mainstream parties has had this effect. But then there's another factor that I think is enormously important here, which is that the populist parties of the populist right, like the Front National in France, and maybe the People's Party in Denmark, a variety of European radical right parties, which have always been relatively authoritarian, if you like, in their moral images, in the values they espouse, used to be on the right side of the political spectrum with regard to economic issues. They used to be laissez-faire parties, worried about state intervention, seeking lower taxes and the like. Think of Pujadisme in France in the 1950s. But that was still the kind of approach you saw in the Front National in the 1980s and 1990s. But since the turn of the last century, these parties have moved to the left on economic issues. They're now offering more economic protection, more social protection, provided, of course, that it doesn't go to immigrants. So there's a welfare chauvinist side to those platforms. But this has made these parties much more appealing to working class voters who might previously have been hesitant to support them because they were seen as having laissez-faire right-wing economic policies. So these parties have now moved into a part of the electoral space, if you like, which really no other party occupies. And this is giving them increasing footholds, if you like, among working class voters in particular.
So in a sense, they're the inverse dynamic development than mainstream parties. Mainstream parties converge on a, broadly speaking, neoliberal economics, vacating that sort of left-leaning socioeconomic space. And but at the same time, in order to differentiate themselves, became culturally more progressive.
Yes.
And these populist parties have always been culturally regressive, but now occupy that vacated space in the socioeconomic sphere.
That's right. That's right. In fact, center-left parties were never in that space because they were always somewhat progressive on values. So they become more so in recent years, as you say. So that really was an empty space. But it's a space that has a lot of voters in it, and indeed in recent years, more voters in it. And so, yes, it's now occupied by the populist right.
And we've already talked about how the behavior differs from the cities to rural areas. Do you see, in the work that you've done, do you see any sort of significant national variations of this populist phenomenon? Or are the trends basically the same everywhere?
Well, you know, as Tolstoy said, that all families are unhappy, but each family is unhappy in its own way. Well, all nations are unhappy, but each nation is unhappy in its own way. And there are very significant variations in populism across countries. And of course, we see left populism attracting many more voters in Southern Europe and right populism attracting more voters in Northern Europe. There are people who explain that in terms of the kind of shocks, if you like, that these countries have experienced. My colleague Danny Roderick, for instance, argues that countries that experience an economic shock, as Southern Europe has in the context of the euro crisis, are more likely to develop strong left populist parties, while countries that experience an immigration shock of the sort that Germany has in recent years are more likely to develop right populist parties. I think there's probably something in that. And there are some differences between right populism in Eastern Europe and in Western Europe, for instance. But what strikes me is how similar right populist parties and their appeals are across Europe and across the Atlantic as well.
And based on this analysis, now we're coming to a question that policymakers across the developed world are pondering. How can you react to this kind of populism? I mean, we've analyzed that, you know, they occupied vacated spaces. But how, as a mainstream politician, how do you sort of counter this populist surge? I mean, so far as I can see, there have been two broad strategies. The one is basically adopting parts of the rhetoric and parts of the agenda, which gives a lot of power effectively to these populist parties, no matter, you know, how big their electoral support actually is, because they have a huge impact on the actual political agenda. I mean, not least UKIP in the United Kingdom is probably a good example. Never had an MP other than Douglas Carswell, but their impact on British politics has been very significant. And the other argument seems to be, do not engage with populists at all, because if you engage with them, you legitimize them as part of the political system, and by doing so, open doors basically for their expansion. So and none of this seems to have worked properly. So what would you suggest?
Well, I think it's not an easy issue, and I don't have ready-made solutions to it. I think this is one of those challenges that will put liberal democracy to the test, and it clearly is at the moment. I think that in order to develop an effective response, what's most important is to realize that there are two dimensions to the underlying problem. One of them is material. Lots of people are feeling more economically insecure. They're not sure that they can support their families in the way that they would like to. Now, economists, many economists suggest that, well, this is the result of the failure of the response to globalization. They said the classic economic formula is globalization helps most people, but it's important to compensate the losers. And so they argue that the response to populism has to involve more compensation for the losers. But I think there's something misleading in that. My sense from interviews and reading the ethnographic literature is that what many of these people want are not more social benefits. What they want are decent jobs, decent jobs that would give them a certain social standing in their community of the sort that they used to be able to expect. So there's a material challenge here, and it's a very, very difficult challenge. It's easy to argue that we need to provide more decent jobs. It's very hard to generate them, as Emmanuel Macron is likely to find out over the next couple of years. On the other hand, existing jobs in many cases can be made more decent. A living wage, better protections, better benefits that allow people to retrain or to move from one job to another. I think that there are actions that can be taken which vary to some extent across countries depending on the state of their political economy. But the other dimension, I think it's equally important to realize that the other dimension is really a dimension that has to do with moral visions. Right populist parties in particular are offering a particular kind of moral vision. It's a reprehensible moral vision, but at its heart is the claim that societies have become unfair. They're treating some people unfairly. Immigrants are getting more than they deserve, more than we're getting. People of other races or religions are getting something that we're not getting. We're not, in general, as I say, the social contract seems to be falling apart. And the only way to respond to that is with a creative politics which advances a new vision of social justice, one that suggests that everyone is part of a society and entitled to the opportunities for themselves and their children that society has long promised. Now, that, as I say, has something to do with delivering those opportunities, but there's no question that the moral vision is important. And I think that that's not going to be found by pandering to the anti-immigrant views of the populist right. And there's hope there, because if we compare the generations, we find that younger generations are much more acceptant of immigrants. They're much more interested in moving across national borders. They're much more supportive of human rights. And so I think that there is a platform within the younger generation that is a powerful place from which to argue against right populism in particular.
I mean, one of the purest expressions of this right-wing populism has been Donald Trump. I mean, the slogan "Make America Great Again" yes. very clearly says the country is going in the wrong direction and will change course. The forgotten people will be forgotten no more. So directly playing into the sentiment that, you know, we've been left behind. You know, we've been falling down in relative terms in the social pecking order. And, you know, you mentioned the moral mission. Is one of the key criteria for this moral mission to reconnect and try to reestablish that respect, that feeling of respect that people have seemingly lost?
Yes, I think that's right. Now, like everything else here, that's easier said than done. On the other hand, no one's going to do it unless they try to do it. And I think that as we look at identity politics today, we have to realize that it has to encompass an expansive range of identities, that tolerance for people who are different is important, but that tolerance includes people who might be older, people who might be white, people who might not have views that are the same as our views. And I think that the best way to counter Donald Trump is to present a vision of the nation which sees its greatness in terms that are very different than those he tends to suggest.
Yeah, and that's always sort of also traditionally been a situation that center-left parties have always found themselves in. Center-left parties tended to do well when they owned the future. So basically, there was a narrative that people believed in.
That's right.
I mean, Tony Blair was a very good expression, things can only get better at the end of the 90s in, yes. in the UK. So when people have faith in the future and believe things are moving in the right direction, that used to be the circumstances in which social democratic parties or center progressive parties mm-hmm. Have traditionally done well, but at the same time, you know, they've really suffered when this is not the case. And you know, there's plenty of evidence across the developed world that progressive parties are in a very tight spot. So you reckon basically the way out must be some sort of attempt to own the future again, to create a new sort of vision for the future based on values that is not regressive, because you don't move back. You don't want to, you know, give up the rights for women and all the other progressive and cosmopolitan rights that were fought for and won for, but sort of have a new inclusive vision for society. Is that really the mission, what you have to come up with? Well, redefine the future.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. The challenge facing mainstream parties on both the center-left and the center-right is that they now both have to hold together uneasy coalitions between middle-class voters and working-class voters. And contemporary developments, which have seen a larger proportion of the population acquire a college education, have driven something of a wedge between those groups in terms of their outlooks on the world and their values and the like. So this is a difficult challenge for both the mainstream left and the mainstream right. On the mainstream left, social democratic parties, the center left, as you know, at the moment, the debate is really couched in terms of two alternatives. One is the alternative represented by Jeremy Corbyn or Bernie Sanders in this country, something that moves a little closer to a left populism. You know, is left populism the best response to right populism? That's really the issue that they raise. Should we be making a frontal assault on inequality, arguing for much higher levels of state intervention? On the other side is the strategy that you just described and that is associated with Tony Blair, although I'm afraid he's not bringing much legitimacy to it these days. And that is a strategy which seeks to appeal to aspirational voters, in particular through education, the development of a knowledge economy, better working conditions, offering them opportunities for their children in particular. And I see that at the moment as the more viable strategy. But it requires the kind of vision for the future that you're talking about. And we don't yet know, I think, which of those strategies is going to prove most successful. I do think that politicians like Corbyn and Sanders and others are doing us all a service by reminding us that we don't have to embrace traditional neoliberal policies of the sort that have created so many problems in the last few decades. We can think in new ways about what governments can do for their economies and the like, and I think we need to do that. So I think they're serving an important political purpose. On the other hand, I suspect that the future of social democracy lies with the quest for aspirational voters through the articulation of a new moral and social vision.
And maybe a synthesis of both, because the you know, what Corbyn and Sanders seem to address are the, what you mentioned, the underlying socioeconomic issues, that sort of left-leaning economic policy space that was vacated by social democracy. And it's not necessarily a conflict, you know, to have both. I mean, you have to win this aspiration game. I mean, I think that's an absolute necessity to do that. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, coming up with an alternative economic policy that manages to reduce economic pressures might just create the space needed to do just that. So maybe it's a mixture of both.
I think that's right, and let's hope the European economy continues to improve and enlarge the space for precisely that.
Let's keep the fingers crossed and hope for the best. Peter, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Thank you very much for listening. We hope you enjoyed it. Make sure you don't miss future episodes by subscribing to Social Europe Podcast. You can also read our articles on www.socialeurope.eu and follow us on Facebook and on Twitter @Social Europe. Until next time.